you all for having me back again. It's a real privilege to be among you, and I don't know if you're meant to have like favorite churches that you come and speak at, but I do, and this is one. It's a really beautiful space here, and I really appreciated your prayers this morning, Colleen. That was really beautiful, I feel really moved. I saw in the outline of the series you had Jono Ingram here, my Baptist brother and colleague. So I trusted that was a good time as well. Jono is one of our great figures of mission in the Baptist Church. I don't know if that's what he was here talking about, but he does an incredible work of placemaking. I trust that that was a good time. This week we're talking about justice and mercy. And the prompt that I was given simply said, moved by compassion, we are advocates for and put into practice justice and mercy. What does this look like? The discipline of justice and mercy also draws us closer to God's heart. And I chose a text from Luke's Gospel, partly because I was teaching it this semester, so it's nice and fresh in my mind. But also, I think more than any other Gospel writer, Luke seeks to engage us in thinking beyond the idea of being saved by faith to considering what action emerges from that saving faith. In many cases, this has to do with actions of justice and mercy. So this morning, we're going to begin looking at this text from Luke 6 and then look at some of the big ideas that underpin it before concluding by thinking about how these ideas apply to us today. So chapter 6 of Luke's Gospel opens like this, and I'm going to be reading from the NRSV. One Sabbath, while Jesus was going through some grain fields, his disciples plucked some heads of grain, rubbed them in their hands, and ate them. This seems like a fairly innocuous act, probably not a very tasty meal, I imagine. And biblical law allows for this. In Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy 23, we read instructions about not reaping all the way to the edge of your fields, not plucking all of the grain, so that people who don't have food can eat any grain that is left over. So what Jesus and his disciples are doing here isn't considered theft. However, we read, but some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" Exodus 20 instructs followers of God to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. However, what work meant here is not really explained in the biblical law. There's a mention of not kindling fire in Exodus 35, but religious leaders had to come up with a variety of definitions of work. And so they had 39 different kinds of work that were prohibited. It included all kinds of things like sifting and kneading and baking, spinning, sewing, and tying, carrying things, as well as reaping, threshing, and grinding grain. So the assumption here is that these Pharisees, who were predominantly local synagogue leaders and quite concerned about the day-to-day observances of the law, thought that what Jesus and his disciples were doing constituted reaping or threshing. From verse 3, we then read that Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.'" It's a fairly cryptic kind of response from Jesus. You might already know the story that he's referring to, where David, before he was king of Israel, is on the run from King Saul. He and his men stopped at the priestly city of Nob, and David took the bread of the presence to feed his men. These were 12 loaves of bread that were baked each week and set before the Ark of the Covenant on a golden table in the tabernacle. Leviticus 24 tells us that these were a symbolic offering to God, and after a time in God's presence, hence the name, the bread of the presence, they were eaten by the priests who were on duty. David was technically breaking the law by eating the bread because he wasn't a priest. Jesus raises the story here as an example of how enforcing the letter of biblical law does not necessarily fulfill the spirit or the goal of biblical law. The goal of biblical law is to uphold shalom, which is a Hebrew word that we often hear translated simply as peace. While there are times in the Bible that this translation makes sense, the word actually has layers of meaning. It refers to the well-being that someone or something experiences when it's functioning according to God's intent and the purpose for which it was created. Shalom is measured in terms of the health of local relationships. So we could suggest that in a church community like this, where relationships are strong and edifying, then there is shalom. Shalom is also inclusive of land and of all of its non-human inhabitants. Finally, the term is inclusive of ideas like righteousness and justice and mercy. The famous Hebrew Bible scholar Walter Brueggemann, who turned 90 this year, and he's still writing books, puts it this way when he says, "Shalom is the substance of the biblical vision of one community embracing all creation. It refers to all those resources and factors that make communal harmony joyous and effective." Now, we're offered a few different opposites of shalom in the Bible, but these boil down to ideas like chaos or evil. Every thought, word, or action is either working toward chaos and evil or toward shalom. This is the image we get in the Hebrew Bible. Those that work toward chaos are those that go against God's intent, and are what we today would call sin. We also understand that sin damages relationships because it creates debt within them. And in the Hebrew Bible, debt became the predominant way in which sin is thought about. So if I were to steal something from you, we would understand that I ought to repay what I've taken in order to repair the relationship. All this is to say that here, Jesus offers an instance where the priestly enforcement of the letter of the law, in this case, preventing David and his companions from eating the bread of the presence, would have worked for chaos and evil rather than for shalom. This suggests that for the Pharisees to prevent Jesus and his disciples from eating this grain from the field on the Sabbath, which in and of itself is already a very strict interpretation of biblical law, is similarly not an enforcement of biblical law that leads towards shalom. And so to strengthen his authority to make this claim, he declares himself Lord of the Sabbath. Now, no part of biblical law was designed to ensure shalom more than the Sabbath laws. We read about the Sabbath day in Exodus, but in Leviticus 25, we read about two more Sabbath institutions. The first of these is the Sabbath year, which is explained like this. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath, you, your male and female slaves, your hired and your bound laborers who live with you, for your livestock also, and for the wild animals in your land, all its yield shall be for food. The aim here is that God's people, the land that they live upon, and all of its non-human inhabitants, are invited to rest for a year, to enjoy shalom. The third Sabbath institution is called the Jubilee Year, which was celebrated every 50th year, so every 7 times 7 years. And it involved an entire economic reset for the nation. Land that had been sold was returned to the families of its original owners, slaves were released, and debt was forgiven. This meant that generational poverty could be prevented because resources were returned to those who had lost them every couple of generations or so. Now, the general consensus is that ancient Israel never really celebrated a Jubilee year quite as Leviticus describes it, but the intent of it was to work towards shalom for the entire nation including the land and all of its inhabitants, not humans alone. English biblical scholar Jonathan Burnside writes that there is a range of institutions of differing scope, shows that each Sabbath institution is limited in what it can do to preserve freedom. Thus, the Sabbath day offers respite for a limited period, but does nothing about debt. The sabbatical year offers relief for a longer period and addresses debt, but does nothing about the alienation of land. The Jubilee year addresses the alienation of land and national financial debt, but does not address non-physical needs, for example, interpersonal forgiveness. And while the Jubilee addresses debt slavery, it doesn't deal with other forms of bondage, for example, physical infirmity and death. It's within this thoroughly Jewish tradition of expanding sabbatical institutions that we can begin to make sense of the New Testament's application of the sabbatical laws. Here in Luke 6, we begin to see how Jesus is applying this biblical law, a sabbatical law. Luke introduces the idea in the first part of the text, but then from verse 6, we see how Jesus lives this out. We read this: "On another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and taught, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. The scribes and the Pharisees were watching him to see whether he would cure on the Sabbath, so that they might find grounds to bring an accusation against him. But he knew what they were thinking, and he said to the man who had the withered hand, 'Come and stand in the middle.' He got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to destroy it?' After looking around at all of them, he said to him, 'Stretch out your hand.' He did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and began discussing with one another what they might do to Jesus." The question that Jesus poses to the religious leaders of the day is simple. Is the goal of biblical law, in particular the Sabbath law, to achieve evil or shalom? I want to put to you this morning that this is a question that's still relevant for us today. In Matthew's gospel, we see Jesus apply the principles of Sabbath and shalom for his own followers, not only those who follow God under older covenants. In Matthew 18, we read from verse 15, "If your brother or sister sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. If you are listened to, you have regained that one. But if you are not listened to, take one or two others along with you, so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If that person refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if the offender refuses to listen even to the church, let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, truly I tell you, if two of you agree on anything about anything you ask, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them." Now these here are important instructions for maintaining shalom, or we might talk about right relationship. But it's Peter's question which brings the earlier segment into focus. From verse 21 we read, "Then Peter came and said to Jesus, 'Lord, if my brother or sister sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times?' Jesus said to him, 'Not seven times, but I tell you, 70 times seven times.'" Jonathan Burnside again tells us that this is a considerable multiplication. Not the number seven as per the Sabbath day and sabbatical year, nor seven times seven as per the Jubilee year, but 70 times seven, a figure of speech for infinity. If the Jubilee year is Sabbath squared, Jesus' approach to the Sabbath of forgiveness is a perpetual Sabbath. So if Jesus is characterizing his own ministry and that of his followers using these ideas of shalom and Sabbath, these ought to be core principles underpinning how we also live today. Jesus offers another example of how this ought to be lived in Matthew 18. We read from verse 23, For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents, which is an astronomical amount of money, more than any one person who is a servant could ever hope to repay, was brought to him. And as he could not pay, the Lord ordered him to be sold, together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything." And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. It's roughly a few months' wages. And seizing him by the throat, he said, "Pay what you owe." Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you." But he refused. Then he went and threw him into prison until he would pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. Then his lord summoned him and said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" And in anger, his lord handed him over to be tortured until he could pay his entire debt. "So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart." Here in the parable of the unforgiving servant, the Lord's question to the servant is our question too. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you? Through the death and resurrection of Jesus, we have had all the debt created by our sinful thoughts, words, and deeds forgiven. And so we are called to be those who show mercy and offer forgiveness from debt where we can. We're empowered by the Spirit of God for this work toward justice and shalom, and away from chaos, sin, and evil. So we could understand our role as advocates and doers of justice and mercy, as those seeking to offer people freedom or release from debt. This might be release from an interpersonal debt, but it might be seeking to bring freedom or release from a broader and more systemic debt. Last time I was here, the church was talking about a meal program that had begun, I think, over the lockdowns, over COVID. This morning, David mentioned providing clothing to kids for their school formal. These are perfect examples of the kind of justice and mercy that I think Jesus is calling us toward. Not only does it show love for our neighbors, but it actively works against an economic system that keeps poor people in poverty and the rich wealthy. These are actions that move away from chaos and evil and toward the goals of the Sabbath, shalom, or well-being, as God intends. At my last church, we partnered with a local emergency relief organization, and that church continues to contribute funds to that organization, as well as having a number of people who volunteer with them. Most recently, they've begun to renovate another building on their property to provide a second location for this organization to operate out of. And this was a great arrangement because the church didn't have the knowledge or the capital to launch an emergency relief organization. But they did have people who were committed to the ministry of justice and mercy in our local community. This meant that the church didn't need to provide oversight or infrastructure of such a program, but they were able to staff it and resource it. So to sum up what I'm saying here, I think that sin and evil has created, or the debt that sin creates, is rife in our world, and we see the consequences of this played out constantly. Colleen prayed to that end this morning. And so as people empowered by the Spirit who have been freed from our own debts, we're called to go and free the debt of others. And so I thought it would be good to spend some time reflecting on what this looks like now and perhaps into the future as well in the Northern Community neighborhood. So there are some questions that are going to pop up on the screen here. What kinds of debt exist within the church community and beyond it? How is the church working toward alleviating this debt? And what other opportunities might exist into the future to work toward justice, mercy, and shalom for this community? So do you normally have some time now to reflect on those? Yeah, great. All right. I'll be quiet, and I'll let you do just that.